Esther. After the news, I'm going to ask John Ziemek, the author, to detail, which he does in the book in minute detail, to tell you exactly what happened, if you don't mind, John.
Okay.
It's such a good book on so many different levels. It's hard for me to believe that this is indeed your first book. I certainly hope it's not his last. I hope the next one is about a subject that is not as... the book is so compelling. I know it deals with a tragedy, but many, 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 many things in life are tragic, and this is one compelling and, I think, ultimately very hopeful read, too. Welcome back to After Hours with Theodore Rick Kogan. We're talking with my old colleague at the Sun-Times, John Ziemek, who got smart and got out of the newspaper business and went on to a distinguished career at Northwestern, where he taught and mentored a bunch of people who spent all day saying, say hi to John for me, say hi to John for me. Not saying it, but texting it. His book is Collision on Tenerife, The How and Why of the World's Worst Aviation Disaster. We've been talking about it and the detail that John has been able to gather from many of the survivors, some from other aviation experts involved, some from psychiatrists. John, I'm going to ask you to detail this crash for me, please.
Okay. Well, the Spanish government, which was in control of the investigation because it was Canary Islands and that's under Spain, took them 18 months to come up with their final report. The main reason, but not the only reason, for the crash was because the KLM pilot began his takeoff before being told to begin his takeoff. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that, but I mentioned earlier I had 11 different circumstances, mistakes, oversights that all had to fall into place. That was the worst one, but there were others. I mean, he and the Pan Am plane, the KLM plane and the Pan Am plane, were both diverted from their original destination because that morning a terrorist group, which was... believed that the Canary Islands should be separate from Spain, set off a bomb at the airport where these two airplanes and others were supposed to land. And just to make it really complicated, there was a bomb threat phoned in to the other airport on Las Palmas, and the operator thought the terrorist on the phone used plural when he said bomb. Did he say bombs? So she passed that along to the airport manager. The bomb that they had set off had already gone off. They thought we better play it safe. They closed the whole airport. All the airplanes coming in were sent over to Tenerife to wait until Las Palmas, the airport that was their original destination, opened up again. While they were waiting, the KLM pilot made a perfectly logical decision and refueled his plane, which then made the plane tens of thousands of pounds heavier, which meant it needed more runway and a faster speed to get off the ground.
God.
If that hadn't happened, they might have missed each other. If Pan Am had waited before taxiing on the runway, they might have missed each other. There are many of these. They're just all this series of coincidences that resulted in the collision. KLM almost made it off the ground. They were about 150 miles an hour and were getting ready to what they call rotate. But that's when Pan Am suddenly was right in front of them on the runway.
And it was
through the fog.
583
people were killed. Everyone on the KLM plane was killed, and all but 54 passengers on the Pan Am plane were killed. And the cockpit crew survived on the Pan Am plane, and four of the flight attendants, they survived also. There was another part of this that I did want to mention, which is that some of the passengers were alert enough to realize they needed to get up and out and fast. There were some estimates that at least 100 people were still alive on the Pan Am plane after the collision, at least that many.
God.
But there was this phenomenon that, again, at the time there wasn't much known about it, what we now refer to as behavioral inaction or frozen fear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Set in for a lot of the people on the Pan Am plane. They never got out of their seats. They, or maybe by the time they did, they were not fast enough to be able to make it out before.
One of the things is about this tragedy is a weird thing, as John Zimek points out late in the book. That the week after the crash, hundreds of people betting in the state of Massachusetts lottery played the number 7470, apparently following the prominence of the 747 airplanes. Incredibly, that number sequence was drawn, but so many more people than usual had bet on the numbers that the parimutuel payout for a $1 bet was reduced from the usual $6,000 to $2,044. John, you can be terribly proud of this book. I know it had to be a difficult one to write, and it did take, you know, it took more than 30 years. It was not because John was lazy he had other jobs. He was a distinguished professor at Northwestern. I know the response to the book has been, certainly from people I know and from what I've read, really good. It's a hard book to promote in this weird publishing environment we were just talking about, but do you feel empowered having done this, John? It's your first book. And is it empowering because there's so much work involved in this thing?
There was a lot of work to get all the details right, but I did also want to make it very clear that there are things that people can do. I mean, being an alert passenger when you get on a plane. You know, this surveys show that about a third of us are actually a little nervous about flying, even if we've never even been in a difficult situation when we get on a plane.
Yeah, sure.
But there are ways to reduce that, and I think just something as simple as reading the card and listening to the flight attendants can actually help reduce one's concerns about flying. Also, it creates a pathway in the brain. And should that 1 in 3 million bad thing happen, and that's about how often, that's how what it was in 2018, one flight out of every 3 million, there was something bad. Should that happen, your brain knows what it's supposed to do. It'll know where you're supposed to get. And
has this at all changed your attitude about flying?
I actually am an easy flyer. I'm not sure why, but especially after this. But no, I'm still fine with flying. Also, I am a flyer who pays attention, and I try to sort of mentally encourage my other passengers to do the same when I get on a plane.
Well, what you should do is have a pile of these books and start selling them at the entrance. At the entrance to the plane. It's not my place to be proud of you at all, but I'm always proud of former colleagues or newspaper guys that really come through and produce something of such great value as is collision on Tenerife, the how and why of the world's worst aviation disaster. I think John does a great job, an incredible job of detailing what went into this tragedy that need not have happened, but also the triumph of some of the people who did survive. It's a remarkable book, John. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And if you see the name Jennifer Zimek on some kind of painting or any other kind of visual artwork, if you're in Los Angeles or in some museum someplace, buy it. John, take care. Thanks so much for coming in. Jennifer, great to see you too.
Thank you.
We'll be back and we'll talk about many things, but the value of arts for children. Welcome back. I've been trying to get Eric Delibovi on for some time, and my fault, he hasn't been. He is the What's that lofty title? President and CEO of Urban Gateways. And Urban Gateways is one of my favorite organizations in Chicago, and it needs to have a higher profile. Do you agree? There are a lot of competing things, and it's easy to get lost in you know, it's a big city, Eric. It's a big city. Welcome to the show, by the
Thanks
way.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Finally. Rick, you finally came through. Urban Gateway started in the early 60s, if memory serves, as a means to enrich the lives of children in Chicago through the arts.
Yeah, it started in 1961 by a woman named Jessie Woods.
Sure.
And she realized there was a huge disparity. There were young people in the city who never been downtown, never saw the lake, never saw live theater, never really saw performances, never really enjoyed all the things that Chicago really has to offer. So
one of the striking things is, and I'll stop you here, and we'll go back if you're here for 40 minutes, is that that is a larger problem today.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I'm not wrong about that.
It's still happening today.
Well, it's worse, I think, because I remember I was in grammar school in 1961, and we had an art teacher, and we had a person who taught music, and that has vanished from public schools, certainly over the last decade or so, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of organizations trying to make sure that the arts are in the schools. There's still great disparities. There's a lot of good work being done. But I think beyond just the school day, there's so many opportunities that young people need. And that's what Urban Gateways is trying to fill. Figure out ways in which we can connect young people to all the artistic and cultural wealth that this city has to offer.
Well, you mentioned the lake and the river. And some years ago, a wonderful folk musician named Tom Castle and I were hanging around. He was working here, working on boats, and he would go to public schools and play songs for the kids. And he told me, shockingly, and saddened me deeply, that in some classes there would be like kind of blank looks, and he would say, "Now, how many of you have been to the lake?" And it was something in the neighborhood, sometimes in some classrooms, in some beaten up neighborhoods, 30%.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are economic reasons, there are, you know, the protective reasons. But do you find that to be still as frighteningly true?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Urban Gateways, I'm proud to say, has been in all 77 neighborhoods, all 50 wards. We're all over the city and beyond every year. So we have a huge reach in terms of kids. But there are many, many kids, especially when we do field trips or a matinee program, bring them to downtown. It's amazing how many haven't seen a live performance or been downtown. And, you know, I think that's the message we're trying to send is that for young people, this is their city, too. And they should be enjoying the city and all the wonderful things that it has to offer.
Thing for the city itself to look at those young people and say the city doesn't speak, but this is our future.
Yeah, absolutely, Rick. I mean, I think too often we talk about the young people in our city as problems to be dealt with, and really we don't look at them as huge assets, that they have something really wonderful to offer our city if we could only stop and listen and really make sure that their voices are heard and that they have the same opportunities that everyone else should have.
Talk to me for a while, Eric Delibovi, about... You know, sometimes people consider the arts and culture something when it comes to, well, we need more money for crayons, and say, well, no, actually, we need another basketball. That the arts are kind of in many people's minds diminished as an important thread to growing up in full ways. I'm sure you've talked about this for hours somewhere, pitching some corporation, but expand on that. You know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we think about arts, it's something, it's an add-on, it's something else that, you know, that would be nice if we have time or we have the money. I look at it as it's a tool. It's really a tool to teach young kids about themselves. We all know the studies are, there's so much research out there that the arts promote empathy, confidence, team building,
collaboration,
curiosity, creativity above all. And we need more of that in our society for sure. And I don't think we should, it has to be one or the other. I think we're talking about a well-rounded education, and the arts and sports and all those things are critical to making sure that
you know, I think, and I know that there are a number of public schools in the city that don't even have, they don't have librarians, they don't have libraries. I mean, I don't know if reading is an intrinsic part of Urban Gateway's mission.
Sure. Well, you know, the arts are a great tool, again, to teach reading, to teach math, to teach many other subjects. It's a way in which you can get kids interested. It's a way to get them engaged. When kids are in the arts, the studies show that they're more likely to show up to school. They're more likely to be more engaged and more excited. And that's something to make learning exciting and engaging is really what we're all about. But yeah, the arts can be used for so much. Absolutely.
By saying all about, I mean, one of the things you have to do necessarily, especially, there's a good side and a bad side to being around since 1961, in that a lot of people are able to take Urban Gateways for granted. Do you find that to be true? Probably not when you go out and speak to them, but it's like, oh yeah, we used to give to Urban Gateways, or there's something new now that we do.
I hope not.
I hope not too. But there's something about being around for a long time that breeds a certain complacency, certainly from the philanthropic community.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the important thing is, I think maybe there's a perception that people know what Urban Gateways is.
Exactly.
And yes, we do. We do programs in the schools, and yes, we do performances. And I think the big part of what we do is connecting young people to professional artists that work in the city. But I think what's really important is the programs we do outside of school too. Making sure that young people are moving about the city and using the city for their own benefit.
Yeah. What about the inherent danger of moving about this city when we have to have, you know, safe passage routes to grammar schools in this town? Has the last decade or last 20 years presented some challenges that perhaps in 1961, I know you weren't around, that you never imagined having to deal with?
The city, the more things change, the more things stay the same. I think what's really important, though, to remember is, yes, I think there's a lot of young people who don't feel safe moving about the city.
Sure.
But at some point, we have to enable... We have to give kids the agency to feel that they are part of this city, that they should be able to move about, that North Siders can go to the South Side and the South Side can go to the North Side. And that's what our new program, the Teen Arts Pass, is really all about.
I'm going to spend a long time. The Teen Arts Pass just fascinates me. But you have so many other programs, too, the professional development, street-level workshops. I want to, in the next half hour, get to, you know, sort of dig a little deeper into each one of those. The Teen Arts Pass, I think, is one of the most innovative and potentially life-altering programs I have ever encountered in this town. How's that
for you? That's great.
Yeah.
I think what's really important is we have to remember that arts and arts education in general doesn't just have to happen in the four walls of the classroom. That this city is full of learning opportunities if we enable young people, give them the tools to be able to move around and enjoy it. Everything from public art to performances, the museums. I mean, we are a world-class destination.
Well, and also you've seen in the last, you know, since the founding of Urban Gateways, sort of the explosion of public art. I mean, to take a mural tour of Chicago is an outdoor museum.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Eric, when did you come to Urban Gateways and where did you come from?
I've been in Chicago since 2000. I used to work at the Old Town School of Folk Music
for many years.
Well. Yep. And
Is that when they moved? Were you there when they moved?
I was there just after they opened the library.
Okay. In Lincoln Square.
Yeah. And then
that kicked the old town school into a new level. Yeah, that's
and
true.
I left in 2012, when the new building opened up, and it was Urban Gateways, who I admired so much for so many years. The opportunity opened up, and I jumped on it. It really came back to what I was most passionate about, was making sure that every young person had access to great arts experiences. And it was something that...
Well, you'd see wiggle worms at the Old Town School and go, wait a minute, everybody should be able to do this.
Yeah,
I know absolutely. What you mean. Yeah. I really know what you mean. Yeah. And that's a good place to have been, because you saw kids, not with a great deal of money, but you know, kids attending classes there, and saw what it could do for them, and think to yourself, well, everybody should have this chance.
Sure.
That's great. It's a pleasure to have you. We're going to dig deeper into many of the programs that Urban Gateway's done. We will dig no more deeply into Ari Delibovi's life and biography, but Urban Gateway. So please stay tuned. Well, I love that formality, Mr. Rick Kogan. I am with Mr. Ari Delibovi, who is the president and CEO of Urban Gateways. Urban Gateways, which has been the business of enriching the lives of Chicago's children since 1961. And that enrichment, I believe, is more important than ever. You have come up, Eric, since 1912 with a number of new programs. I think the artist residencies have been around for a while, have they not?
Absolutely, yeah.
What is that?
So the artist residencies, we have an amazing roster of professional artists in music, dance, theater, visual arts. Yep, these are professional working artists who are trained as arts educators, and we connect them to Chicago's classrooms. We make sure that it's basically a residency, so they'll be making art. The idea is using a piece of art as sort of a grounding piece, and they'll work on that. Maybe it'll involve a field trip, but basically they're learning about that art form. They're doing the art form. They reflect on it. We celebrate it. So whether it's a dance performance, an art exhibition, but really making sure they're getting hands-on arts experiences from K through 12.
How many do you have, roughly, on any given semester in...
Gosh, we're in probably about 60 or 70 schools.
That's good.
And then our performances, our touring performances, that's another 200. So in any given year, we're touching the lives of about 70,000 kids
a year.
See,
the other great thing about it is the ripple effect of that is helping support adult working artists in the city of Chicago, not forcing them to run off to L.A. or, you know, Detroit or, you know, St. Louis or some other climb, that you're giving them. You're not paying them fortunes to do this, but at least a kind of living wage that helps supplement their artistic endeavors.
Yeah, absolutely. We couldn't do it without the artists that Urban Gateways works with, and I think that's what's really wonderful when young people can see that making art could be a viable profession. Certainly here in Chicago, I think that's that sets up the next generation of artists that Chicago needs to thrive.
Well, and you have there are a number of success stories. We were talking off air about a couple of mutual friends in Orbert Davis and Reginald Robinson, who is one of the great stories in the history of this town.
Yeah, he credits Urban Gateways. Orbert Davis was a teaching artist at some point and went into his school and did a workshop. And I think that was when Reginald went home and said, I think I know what I want to do with my life.
Mom, I think I need a piano and he's a MacArthur. He is virtually without argument the leading ragtime composer of this century in the later part of the 20th century. Still, Reggie'd still always be a kid to me. And he must be. Does he do any of the artist residencies? Has he done that
anymore
yet?
He's
I'll bet when he did, he was unbelievably inspiring, because he comes from the same kind of neighborhood that is most in need.
Yeah, we connected with him a few years ago to help us with some fundraising. I owe him a call.
Yeah, well, he's owe him a lot. He's just one of the nicest human beings in the world. And you also do workshops as professional development. What aspect is that of what you do?
Sure. Well, what we try to do also is making sure that the teachers in the classrooms also feel equipped, that they can bring arts in the classroom, that they feel comfortable about it. The thing is I think especially when you're a teacher and you're not versed in the arts, they think, well, you know, I don't want to do it. I might not look great in front of my kids if I don't know how to paint. But that's just the thing. You want adults to show kids that we learn too, and we struggle sure. with things, and we fail, and we try again, and we persevere. So trying to get them comfortable around that, and giving them the tools so when Urban Gateways isn't there, the arts can still continue.
Well, what is the process for one to become an artist in residence, let's say?
Artists,
you can't just walk in and say, yeah. Hey, Eric, I'm a folk singer.
Yeah, no, there's an extensive amount of training. We're very fortunate to have artists who have many years of experience doing the work. It's a pretty rigorous process. We have about 55 artists on our roster. We're always looking for more great artists, but that's the first and foremost, they have to be professional artists. That's their first gig. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And then have experience in education, and we work with them over a period of time and make sure that they're fully equipped, but it's a pretty extensive process.
How does something like Kevin Koval and Louder Than a Bomb and Young Chicago Writers fit into this? Does it fit in, or is that a separate? I know it's not aligned with Urban Gateways, but you must as residents have some poets.
Yeah, well, we do have poets as well, and actually we do cross over a bit because level program, and a lot of our young people go and see their amazing programs and participate in their wonderful programs as well. They're a really great organization who isn't too far down the street from our street level location.
What, talk to me about street level. I'm intrigued by that too.
Sure. Yeah. Street level youth media started in about mid 90s. And it was a program. It was basically a gang intervention program using film. It evolved over the years. It's an incredible organization, incredible model, using media to get kids excited about that kind of art form, and actually talking about what mattered to them, getting their voice. Wonderful organization. A couple of years ago, we were trying to figure out how we can reach more youth outside of the school, in addition, because, you know, school day only lasts so long. There's only 5 days a week they're doing it. So we wanted to do more. And Street Level was looking for a new transition. So we came together in a wonderful merger. And so now Urban Gateways operates its first actual education facility, multimedia facility on North and Ashland.
Wow.
Free programs for young people about 16 through about 24, and they can come learn everything from DJing to sound engineering to green screen technology and everything in between. They do podcasts. There's a journalism program. There's amazing things. And I got to tell you, there's some real talent at that place that's coming out of there, and I'm excited to see where they're
going.
Well,
you look excited.
Yeah.
You see this on TV.
I learn more hanging out with the young people at Street Level, and I think we provide them. So it's a wonderful, wonderful program. And so if there's any young people out there who are looking to learn technical skills in media, check out Street Level.
You can get a ton of information by going to urbangateways.org. You will learn a ton. You'll even have a little biography of Eric Delibovi here. You obviously love your job. Part of your job, though, entails, as it is for any CEO and president, fundraising.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you like that?
You know, when you believe in a mission like I do, it's easy to talk about. It's easy to sell. It's a job. It's very expensive to provide free programs to that many young people across the city.
What's your budget?
We're about $2.7 million. So it's a
doesn't seem like enough. Well, of course, it doesn't seem like enough to me. Yeah,
right. There's always can be more, but certainly the impact we're making on our programs, and that's the thing, was we don't just go in one lane. We're doing programs for many ages, many different ways that we're delivering.
What are the ages? Like, is it like 13 to maybe 24? You mentioned 24, 25 years old, or is it younger and older?
Sure, depends on the program. So our touring and our residencies, our school-based programs, they can go anywhere from pre-K all the way up to 12th grade. Our street-level program is mostly for older teens and the young adults. And then our teen arts pass is for 13 through 19-year-olds.
That is what we're going to concentrate on, because I am incredibly taken with this teen arts pass, because I know a little girl who has availed herself of this, my little girl, who happens to be 14. And I think it's one of the best programs I've ever heard about. We got to take a little commercial break, then we'll come back and we'll spend the rest of this program telling you about Teen Arts Pass. So get a pencil and paper, if you still use pencil and paper, and take down some information, because this is summer's here too, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're going to spend, first I'm going to tell you, I don't know if anybody can go to this. Can anybody go to this, Eric Delibo?
As long as you're 21 and older, yeah.
Okay, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, on June 10th, which is a week from today, yes? June 10th. Yes. Yeah, it's a week from today. From 5:30 to 8:30 at Lagunitas Tap Room, where everything seems to happen, there's a fundraiser for the Urban Gateways Associate Board, and Lagunitas are putting this on. $15, and it goes to such a good cause. And it's a place, if you don't want to go to the urbangateways.org website, you can learn more about it from the people who run it. You'll be there, right?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, be on Monday.
To say, where's Eric? Where's Eric? Where's Eric? Is it a Monday?
It is a Monday.
Oh, it is a Monday. I'm sorry. I can't even add. Yeah, tomorrow is June 3rd. And it is on June 10th, so a week from Monday. Okay, the Teen Arts Pass started when? Whose idea was it? What genius came up with this?
it's been around for 1 year. This was a few years ago. We were doing a lot of field trips. We were moving kids back and forth across the city. One that you're familiar with Mona Golubac,
Georgia Wollaston
Lane. Yeah,
sure.
We did a few years ago. And which was wonderful. We had 6,000 kids go through the Harris Theater for that show.
Wow.
And we love doing those. But I was starting to think there's got to be a better way to connect kids to more theater. So they go see a wonderful show. How do we get more kids out there? I met someone from a wonderful organization in Seattle called Teen Ticks, who explained to me their model. And I sat there for about 10 seconds. I looked him in the eye and he said, I'm taking your I'm stealing your idea. I'm bringing it to Chicago. And not only that, we hired them as consultants to come and help adapt the model from Seattle to Chicago. So it launched a year ago. And it's incredibly simple.
Oh, it is so easy. Yeah. Go ahead, explain it.
Yeah, absolutely. Any teen ages 13 through 19 simply goes to teenartspass.org. They register for free. It takes about 2 minutes. Right away, we email you a card that gives you your registration card, and later we'll mail you a physical card. From there, you just start looking at the events page, and if there is a show on there, all you have to do is call the box office. Any day of show, if there is an unsold ticket at that venue, that teen can buy it for $5 cash. So all I have to do is call the box office. They say there's tickets available. They head to the box office with a $5 bill, and they're in the door. And every participating partner also offers at least once a week, if not more, a companion ticket, so that young person can also take mom or dad or older brother or a non-TAP member.
Parent.
Yeah, parent, anybody.
Yeah, I have found this to be an astonishing program, and I know a number of people who have used it to their benefit, to see shows at Looking Glass. I don't know if they've seen Hamilton, but I would imagine that even some kids have gotten in a teen pass on Hamilton.
We're not a Hamilton yet.
You aren't? That's ridiculous.
We're trying to get the for-profit theaters to pay attention, but we do have 26 amazing partners, and they were chosen for their geographic representation. We wanted venues all across the city, large, small, medium, music, dance, theater, so there was enough of a variety so young people can find what they're looking for. And maybe not have to go all about, but certainly West Side Story has been very popular. The Nutcracker is always
at
very
the Lyric.
Popular.
West Side Story at the Lyric. Yep. Kids have gone for $5 to see it with companion.
Yeah, so our 26 partners who span the city, again, are completely amazing, and they understand that benefit, right? They can either have an empty seat, or they can invite a teen in for $5.
Or they can nurture, there are a lot of kids. I remember I taught at Columbia College for one horrifying semester when I was teaching an arts and criticism class, and I sent, because I was involved in so many theaters, I said, you know what we'll do? I can't teach you to be a critic in 9 weeks, so go see a show. Write a review, come back, we'll talk about it, then go see another show. And they went to Zany's, they went to the Goodman. And one kid, 18 years old, wrote a review, started out with the play, whatever it was, at the Goodman, is very much like a television show, but the actors are real and they're in front of you. And I thought, I kept reading and I realized, oh my God, he's never seen a play before.
Yeah.
Which is really something. And I think theater for kids, especially in this movie video age, can be a life-altering experience.
Absolutely. Theater, and you know, what's so great is listening to the young people who go. The symphony is also incredibly popular. Now, some young people don't see classical music as something that they could ever be into.
Yeah.
But I keep hearing over and over again, once they sit down and they talk about the music just simply moving through them, they're going back.
See, but the other thing, it's the intimacy of the experience too, and the visual, visceral feel. You know, if you sat down and played a classical piece for a classroom.
Yeah.
I'll give you that there may be some people who go, this is boring, but if they are sitting there watching the dozens of instruments, it's a vastly different and, I think, more enriching experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, well, the two things that we were trying to tackle was, one was the cost of the show, and also centralizing the information. So it's very hard for, you know, even adults, but teens, to figure out what is really available. And what they also know about the program is all the partners have undergone training to understand when a teen walks into your space that you have to go above and beyond to make sure that they feel as welcome as possible.
Not intimidated. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Some of these places can be kind of intimidating.
Well, the Lyric, walking in, no question.
Yeah. But the partners have been absolutely—
What are some of your other partners?
Let's see. We've got the Lyric and the Goodman and the Symphony Downtown. We've got
Looking Glass, obviously.
Looking Glass.
What about Court?
Court, yes.
In Hyde Park.
University of Chicago, Logan Center, ETA Arts. Yeah. So
now, I am sure when you went to these institutions and made your pitch, how did you make the pitch? What did you say to them? And who did you meet? Obviously maybe not Bob Falls at the Goodman, but maybe Bob Falls, who knows, or Brock Schulfer.
Yeah, it was either the executive directors, and certainly we reached out to the marketing folks. They're the ones charged with selling tickets.
Yeah, filling seats.
You know, we put it as a value proposition. You can leave it empty and have $0. You can get $5, but also have a future patron. I must say, some of these partners, though, have been doing a lot of work reaching out to young people
exactly.
and doing education programs.
Yeah.
So many were already bought in, and what they really liked about it was it made sense. Every experience is supposed to be the same for the teenagers. So there isn't different rules for different places. They know when they go from one venue to the other, it's the same process no matter what. And really buying into the notion that, again, young people have something to offer being in that space.
No question.
Yeah.
Well, it's your future audience. You don't have to do, it is audience development on its most frugal and inexpensive level. You are nurturing future theater goers.
Yeah.
What do you hear from kids? How many, do you have a number of how many kids there are availing themselves of TAP?
Yeah, just in 1 year, we've got over 6,000 young people that have signed up, and about 2,000 tickets have already been sold throughout
wow.
the city, and it's growing every day. So that's really exciting. We're trying to find funding to continue pushing this, getting the word out. We've been investing in CTA ads, everything from sort of high-tech outreach to low-tech. So the low-tech is going to schools and physically signing up, having our council. We have a TAP Teen Council, a group of young people who we pay to actually give us advice on how to talk to teens.
Wow, that must, those must be interesting conversations.
Yeah.
Holy cow!
So they're really critical to this to this success of the program, to really make sure that young people know that it's by and for teens. That's what's really critical.
Do you expect this to pick up in the summer? Because I remember, you know, there used to be summer jobs for teenagers, and I know there aren't anymore. And this is, you know, and I know all kids don't want to be theater nerds, but a lot of them, it's a bold and interesting and new thing for kids to do.
Yeah, we're gonna see. This will really be, I think, our first test. The trouble is that many of the theaters are starting to wind down their season, so yeah. The calendar is a little thin. We do work with the city, though, with all the free events, and we make sure that the kids understand that there's a lot out there to see. But it's really about, again, agency and knowing that they can go out and try something. Who knows, they might be blown away or they might not like it at all.
Yeah,
they're out $5 in a couple hours of their time, but they probably got something out of it.
And they may have gone to a neighborhood they've never been in before. They may, if they go to Looking Glass, they see the water tower for the first time.
You know, and that it really comes full circle to what Urban Gateways was founded on. And that's what's really great. Almost 60 years later, Urban Gateways is still focusing on making sure that young people know that the city is theirs. What we're just doing with this program is giving them the agency. It's, you know, we'll do a field trip and say, hey, kids, we're gonna put you on a bus, you're going to go see the ballet, and you're going to go back to your school, and you're going to love it, I promise. Now it's, you want to go see the ballet, go see the ballet. You want to go see jazz, go see jazz.
Well, it's also a way for them to learn self-sufficiency.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's a real confidence building thing in two little kids, everybody's a little kid to me, but two little kids, you know, one day going downtown to see a show, to see a play. In the couple of minutes we have left, what's the biggest challenge facing you, Ari, Lily Bobby, and Urban Gateways?
Sure. I think what you said before, making sure that everybody understands what Urban Gateways does, that it really is a Chicago institution, that it really is essential to the fabric of our city, what we're doing, that we're trying to foster the next generation of artists, arts patrons, art appreciators. And even if they don't go in the arts, we know that these experiences set up young people for success later in life.
Yeah, there's no question.
Yeah. I mean, and just making sure that we can get this work done. Our partnerships have been amazing. We do get a lot of support, but more is needed. The need is there. Young people need these experiences, and we're ready to keep
expanding. I think the need is increasingly there. Yeah. I'm not calling it some crisis moment, but it's increasingly there. It is a pleasure to finally meet you face-to-face, and I could not admire what you do any more than I already do.
Oh,
but then I also write about it, and that's what I actually do for a living. Eric Delibovi, you can go to urbangateways.org. It's a wonderful website. You can hear about this party a week from Monday, but you can also hear about TAP. If you've got a teenager in your family, let's say you like to go to theater. Just, okay, your kid's 13. Make him become a TAP member and make him take you as his guest, his or her guest, every time. Thank you all for listening. Roel Coleman, thanks for this extraordinary producing job today. And you, Dan Long, for engineering brilliantly. Thanks to all of you guests. Carl Amari is coming up, and I will, God willing, see you next Sunday, Esther. After the news, I'm going to ask John Ziemek, the author, to detail, which he does in the book in minute detail, to tell you exactly what happened, if you don't mind, John. It's such a good book on so many different levels. It's hard for me to believe that this is indeed your first book. I certainly hope it's not his last. I hope the next one is about a subject that is not as... the book is so compelling. I know it deals with a tragedy, but many things in life are tragic, and this is one compelling and I think ultimately very hopeful read, too. Welcome back to After Hours and Theodore Kogan. We're talking with my old colleague at the Sun-Times, John Ziemek, who went on, who got smart and got out of the newspaper business and went on to a distinguished career at Northwestern, where he taught and mentored a bunch of people who spent all day saying, say hi to John for me, say hi to John for me. Not saying it, but texting it. His book is Collision on Tenerife, The How and Why of the World's Worst Aviation Disaster. We've been talking about it and the detail that John has been able to gather from many of the survivors, some from other aviation experts involved, some from psychiatrists. John, I'm going to ask you to detail this crash for me, please.
Okay. Well, the Spanish government, which was in control of the investigation because it was Canary Islands and that's under Spain, took them 18 months to come up with their final report. The main reason, but not the only reason, for the crash was because the KLM pilot began his takeoff before being told to begin his takeoff. Now, that there's a couple of reasons for that, but I mentioned earlier I had 11 different circumstances, mistakes, oversights that all had to fall into place. That was the worst one, but there were others. I mean, he... and the Pan Am plane, the KLM plane and the Pan Am plane were both diverted from their original destination because that morning a terrorist group, which was believed that the Canary Islands should be separate from Spain, set off a bomb at the airport where these two airplanes and others were supposed to land. And just to make it really complicated, there was a bomb threat phoned in to the other airport on Las Palmas, and the operator thought the terrorist on the phone used plural when he said bomb. Did he say bomb or bombs? So she passed that along to the airport manager. The bomb had, that they had set off had already gone off. They thought, we'd better play it safe. They closed the whole airport. All the airplanes coming in were sent over to Tenerife to wait until Las Palmas, the airport that was their original destination, opened up again. While they were waiting, the KLM pilot made a perfectly logical decision and refueled his plane, which then made the plane tens of thousands of pounds heavier, which meant it needed more runway and a faster speed to get off the ground. God. If that hadn't happened, they might have missed each other. If Pan Am had waited before taxiing on the runway, they might have missed each other. There are many of these. They just had this series of coincidences that resulted in the collision. KLM almost made it off the ground. They were about 150 miles an hour and were getting ready to what they call rotate. And but that's when Pan Am suddenly was right in front of them on the runway.
And it was
through the fog.
583
people were killed. Everyone on the KLM plane was killed, and all but 54 passengers on the Pan Am plane were killed. And the cockpit crew survived on the Pan Am plane, and four of the flight attendants. They survived also. There was another part of this that I did want to mention, which is that some of the passengers were alert enough to realize they needed to get up and out and fast. There were some estimates that at least 100 people were still alive on the Pan Am plane after the collision, at least that many.
God.
But there was this phenomenon that, again, at the time there wasn't much known about it, what we now refer to as behavioral inaction or frozen fear. Set in for a lot of the people on the Pan Am plane. They never got out of their seats. They were not fast enough to be able to make it out before.
One of the things is about this tragedy is a weird thing, as John Ziemek points out late in the book. that the week after the crash, hundreds of people betting in the state of Massachusetts lottery played the number 7470, apparently following the prominence of the 747 airplanes. Incredibly, that number sequence was drawn, but so many more people than usual had bet on the numbers that the parimutuel payout for a $1 bet was reduced from the usual $6,000 to $2,044. John, you can be terribly proud of this book. I know it had to be a difficult one to write, and it did take, you know, it took more than 30 years. It was not because John was lazy he had other jobs. He was a distinguished professor at Northwestern. I know the response to the book has been, certainly from people I know and from what I've read, really good. It's a hard book to promote in this weird publishing environment we were just talking about. But do you feel empowered having done this, John? It's your first book. And is it empowering because there's so much work involved in this thing?
There was a lot of work to get all the details right. But I did also want to make it very clear that there are things that people can do. I mean, being an alert passenger when you get on a plane, you know, this surveys show that about a third of us are actually a little nervous about flying, even if we've never even been in a difficult situation when we get out of a plane.
Yeah, sure.
But there are ways to reduce that. And I think just something as simple as reading the card and listening to the flight attendants can actually help reduce one's concerns about flying. Also, it creates a pathway in the brain. And should that 1 in 3 million bad thing happen, and that's about how often, that's how what it was in 2018, one flight out of every 3 million, there was something bad. Should that happen, your brain knows what it's supposed to do. It'll know where you're supposed to get.
Has this at all changed your attitude about flying?
I actually am an easy flyer. I'm not sure why, but especially after this. But no, I'm still fine with flying. Also, I am a flyer who pays attention, and I try to sort of mentally encourage my other passengers to do the same when I get on a plane.
Well, what you should do is have a pile of these books and start selling them at the entrance to the plane. It's not my place to be proud of you at all, but I'm always proud of former colleagues or newspaper guys really come through and produce something of such great value as is Collision on Tenerife, the how and why of the world's worst aviation disaster. I think John does a great job, an incredible job of detailing what went into this tragedy that need not have happened, but also the triumph of some of the people who did survive. It's a remarkable book, John. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And if you see the name Jennifer Ziemek on some kind of painting or any other kind of visual artwork, if you're in Los Angeles or in some museum someplace, buy it. John, take care. Thanks so much for coming in. Jennifer, great to see you too.
Thank you.
We'll be back and we'll talk about many things, but the value of arts for children. Welcome back. I've been trying to get Eric Delibovi on for some time, and my fault, he hasn't been. He is the, what's that lofty title, President and CEO of Urban Gateways, and Urban Gateways is one of my favorite organizations in Chicago, and it needs to have a higher profile. Do you agree? There are a lot of competing things, and it's easy to get lost in, you know, it's a big city, Eric. It's a big city. Welcome to the show, by the
Thanks
way.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Finally. Rick, you finally came through. Urban Gateway started in the early 60s, if memory serves, as a means to enrich the lives of children in Chicago through the arts.
Yeah, it started in 1961 by a woman named Jessie Woods.
Sure.
And she realized there was a huge disparity. There were young people in the city who never been downtown, never saw the lake, never saw live theater, never really saw performances, never really enjoyed all the things that Chicago really has to offer. So
one of the striking things is, and I'll stop you here, and we'll go back because you're here for 40 minutes, is that that is a larger problem today.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I'm not wrong about that.
There's it's still happening today.
Well, it's worse, I think, because I remember I was in grammar school in 1961, and we had an art teacher, and we had a person who taught music, and that has vanished from public schools, certainly over the last decade or so, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of organizations trying to make sure that the arts are in the schools. There's still great disparities. There's a lot of good work being done, but I think beyond just the school day, there's so many opportunities that young people need. And that's what Urban Gateways is trying to fill, figure out ways in which we can connect young people to all the artistic and cultural wealth that this city has to offer.
Well, you mentioned the lake and the river, and some years ago, a wonderful folk musician named Tom Castle and I were hanging around. He was working here, working on boats, and he would go to public schools and play songs for the kids. And he told me, shockingly, and saddened me deeply, that in some classes there would be like kind of blank looks, and he would say, "Now, how many of you have been to the lake?" And it was something in the neighborhood, sometimes in some classrooms, in some beaten-up neighborhoods, 30%.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, for their economic reasons, their, you know, the protective reasons. But do you find that to be still as frighteningly true?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Urban Gateways, I'm proud to say, has been in all 77 neighborhoods, all 50 wards. We're all over the city and beyond every year. So we have a huge reach in terms of kids. But there are many, many kids, especially when we do field trips or a matinee program, bring them to downtown. It's amazing how many haven't seen a live performance or been downtown. And, you know, I think that's the message we're trying to send is that for young people, this is their city, too. And they should be enjoying the city and all the wonderful things that it has to offer.
Thing for the city itself to look at those young people and say the city doesn't speak, but this is our future.
Yeah, absolutely, Rick. I mean, I think too often we talk about the young people in our city as problems to be dealt with, and really we don't look at them as huge assets, that they have something really wonderful to offer our city if we could only stop and listen and really make sure that their voices are heard and that they have the same opportunities that everyone else should have.
He talked to me for a while, Eric Delibovi, about... You know, sometimes people consider the arts and culture something when it comes to, well, we need more money for crayons, and say, well, no, actually, we need another basketball. That the arts are kind of, in many people's minds, diminished as an important thread to growing up in full ways. I'm sure you've talked about this for hours somewhere, pitching some corporation, but expand on that. You know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we think about arts, it's something, it's an add-on, it's something else that, you know, that would be nice if we have time or we have the money. I look at it as it's a tool. It's really a tool to teach young kids about themselves. We all know the studies are, there's so much research out there that the arts promote empathy, confidence, team building,
collaboration,
curiosity, creativity above all. And we need more of that in our society for sure. And I don't think we should, it has to be one or the other. I think we're talking about a well-rounded education, and the arts and sports and all those things are critical to making sure that young people have
an opportunity. You know, I think, that there are a number of public schools in the city that don't even have, they don't have librarians, they don't have libraries. I mean, I don't know if reading is an intrinsic part of Urban Gateway's mission.
Sure. Well, you know, the arts are a great tool, again, to teach reading, to teach math, to teach many other subjects. It's a way in which you can get kids interested. It's a way to get them engaged. When kids are in the arts, the studies show that they're more likely to show up to school. They're more likely to be more engaged and more excited. And that's something to make learning exciting and engaging is really what we're all about. But yeah, the arts can be used for so much. Absolutely.
By saying all about, I mean, one of the things you have to do necessarily, especially, there's a good side and a bad side to being around since 1961, in that a lot of people are able to take urban gateways for granted. Do you find that to be true? Probably not when you go out and speak to them, but it's like, oh yeah, we used to give to urban gateways, or there's something new now that we do.
I hope not.
I hope not too. But there's something about being around for a long time that breeds a certain complacency, certainly from the philanthropic community.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the important thing is, I think maybe there's a perception that people know what Urban Gateways is.
Exactly.
And yes, we do. We do programs in the schools, and yes, we do performances. And I think the big part of what we do is connecting young people to professional artists that work in the city. But I think what's really important is the programs we do outside of school too. Making sure that young people are moving about the city and using the city for their own benefit.
Yeah. What about the inherent danger of moving about this city when we have to have, you know, safe passage routes to grammar schools in this town? Has the last decade or last 20 years presented some challenges that perhaps in 1961, I know you weren't around, that you never imagined having to deal with?
This, like we said, the city, the more things change, the more things stay the same. I think what's really important, though, to remember is, yes, I think there's a lot of young people who don't feel safe moving about
sure,
the city.
Sure.
But at some point, we have to enable... We have to give kids the agency to feel that they are part of this city, that they should be able to move about, that North Siders can go to the South Side and the South Side can go to the North Side. And that's what our new program, the Teen Arts Pass, is really all about.
I'm going to spend a long time. The Teen Arts Pass just fascinates me. But you have so many other programs, too, the professional development, street-level workshops. I want to, in the next half hour, get to, you know, sort of dig a little deeper into each one of those. The Teen Arts Pass, I think, is one of the most innovative and potentially life-altering programs I have ever encountered in this town. How's that
Thank
for you?
That's great.
Yeah.
I think what's really important is we have to remember that arts and arts education in general doesn't just have to happen in the four walls of the classroom, that this city is full of learning opportunities if we enable young people, give them the tools to be able to move around and enjoy it. Everything from public art to performances, the museums. I mean, we are world-class destination.
Well, and also you've seen in the last, you know, since the founding of Urban Gateways, sort of the explosion of public art. I mean, to take a mural tour of Chicago is outdoor museum.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Eric, when did you come to Urban Gateways and where did you come from?
I've been in Chicago since 2000. I used to work at the Old Town School of Folk Music for many years.
Well.
Yep. And
is that when they moved? Were you there when they moved?
I was there just after they opened the library.
Okay. In Lincoln Square.
Yeah. And then
that kicked the Old Town School up to a new level. Yeah, that's
and
very
I left in 2012 when the new building opened up. And it was Urban Gateways, who I admired so much for so many years. The opportunity opened up and I jumped on it. It really came back to what I was most passionate about, was making sure that every young person had access to great arts experiences. And it was something that...
you'd see Wiggle Worms at the Old Town School and go, wait a minute, everybody should be able to do this.
Yeah,
I know
absolutely.
What you mean. I really know what you mean. Yeah. And that's a good place to have been, because you saw kids, not with a great deal of money, but you know, kids attending classes there, mm-hmm. and saw what it could do for them. And think to yourself, well, everybody should have this chance.
Sure.
That's great. It's a pleasure to have you. We're going to dig deeper into many of the programs that Urban Gateway's done. We will dig no more deeply into Ari Delibovi's life and biography, but Urban Gateway. So please stay tuned. Well, I love that formality, Mr. Rick Kogan. I am with Mr. Ari Delibovi, who is the president and CEO of Urban Gateways. Urban Gateways, which has been the business of enriching the lives of Chicago's children since 1961. And that enrichment, I believe, is more important than ever. You have come up, Eric, since 1912 with a number of new programs. I think the artist residencies have been around for a while, have they not?
Absolutely, yeah.
What is that?
So the artist residencies, we have an amazing roster of professional artists in music, dance, theater, visual arts. Yep, these are professional working artists who are trained as arts educators, and we connect them to Chicago's classrooms. We make sure that it's basically a residency, so they'll be making art. The idea is using a piece of art as sort of a grounding piece, and they'll work on that. Maybe it'll involve a field trip, but basically they're learning about that art form. They're doing the art form. They reflect on it. We celebrate it. So whether it's a dance performance, an art exhibition, but really making sure they're getting hands-on arts experiences from K through 12.
How many do you have, roughly, on any given semester in...
Gosh, we're in probably about 60 or 70 schools.
Oh, that's good.
And then our performances, our touring performances, that's another 200. So in any given year, we're touching the lives of about 70,000 kids
a year.
See,
the other great thing about it is the ripple effect of that is helping support adult working artists in the city of Chicago, not forcing them to run off to L.A. or, you know, Detroit or, you know, St. Louis or some other climb, that you're giving them, you know, you're not paying them fortunes to do this, but at least a kind of living wage that helps supplement their artistic endeavors.
Yeah, absolutely. We couldn't do it without the artists that Urban Gateways works with. And I think that's what's really wonderful. When young people can see that making art could be a viable profession, certainly here in Chicago, I think that's, you know, that sets up the next generation of artists that Chicago needs to thrive.
Well, and there are a number of success stories. We were talking off air about a couple of mutual friends in Orbert Davis and Reginald Robinson, who is one of the great stories in the history of this town.
Yeah, he credits Urban Gateways. Orbert Davis was a teaching artist at some point and went into his school and did a workshop. And I think that was when Reginald went home and said, I think I know what I want to do with my life.
Mom, I think I need a piano. And he's a MacArthur. He is virtually without argument the leading ragtime composer of this century in the later part of the 20th century. Still, Reggie'd still always be a kid to me. And he must be. Does he do any of the artist residencies? Has he done that
anymore
yet?
He's.
I'll bet when he did, he was unbelievably inspiring, because he comes from the same kind of neighborhood that is most in need.
Yeah, we connected with him a few years ago to help us with some fundraising. I owe him a call.
Yeah, well, he's I owe him a lot. He's just one of the nicest human beings in the world. And you also do workshops as professional development. What aspect is that of what you do?
Sure. Well, what we try to do also is making sure that the teachers in the classrooms also feel equipped, that they can bring arts in the classroom, that they feel comfortable about it. The thing is I think, especially when you're a teacher and you're not versed in the arts, they think, well, you know, I don't want to do it. I might not look great in front of my kids if I don't know how to paint. But that's just the thing. You want adults to show kids that we learn too, and we struggle with things, and we fail, and we try again, and we persevere. So trying to get them comfortable around that, and giving them the tools so when Urban Gateways isn't there, the arts can still continue.
Well, what is the process for one to become an artist in residence, let's say?
Artists,
you can't just walk in and say, "Hey, Eric, I'm a folk singer."
Yeah, no, there's an extensive amount of training. We're very fortunate to have artists who have many years of experience doing the work. So it's a pretty rigorous process. We have about 55 artists on our roster. We're always looking for more great artists, but that's the first and foremost, they have to be professional artists. That's their first gig. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And then have experience in education, and we work with them over a period of time and make sure that they're fully equipped, but it's a pretty extensive process.
How does something like Kevin Koval and Louder Than a Bomb and Young Chicago Writers fit into this? Does it fit in, or is that a separate? I know it's not aligned with Urban Gateways, but you must,
sure,
you must as residents have some poets.
Yeah, well, we do have poets as well, and actually our we do cross over a bit because we
have our straight
level program, and a lot of our young people go and see their amazing programs and participate in their wonderful programs as well. So yeah, they're a really great organization who isn't too far down the street from our street level location.
Talk to me about street level. I'm intrigued by that too.
Sure. Yeah. Street level youth media started in about mid 90s, and it was a program. It was basically a gang intervention program using film. It evolved over the years. It's an incredible organization, incredible model, using media to get kids excited about that kind of art form, and actually talking about what mattered to them, getting their voice. Wonderful organization. A couple of years ago, we were trying to figure out how we can reach more youth outside of the school, in addition, because school day only lasts so long. There's only 5 days a week they're doing it. So we wanted to do more. And Street Level was looking for a new transition. So we came together in a wonderful merger. And so now Urban Gateways operates its first actual education facility, multimedia facility on North and Ashland.
Wow.
Free programs for young people about 16 through about 24, and they can come learn everything from DJing to sound engineering to green screen technology and everything in between. They do podcasts. There's a journalism program. There's amazing things. And I got to tell you, there's some real talent at that place that's coming out of there, and I'm excited to see where they're
going. Wow, you look excited. Yeah.
You can
see this on TV.
I learn more hanging out with the young people at street level, and I think we provide them. So it's a wonderful, wonderful program. And so if there's any young people out there who are looking to learn technical skills in media, check out street level.
You can get a ton of information by going to urbangateways.org. You will learn a ton. You'll even have a little biography of Eric Delibovi here. You obviously love your job. Part of your job, though, entails, as it is for any CEO and president, fundraising.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you like that?
When you believe in a mission like I do, it's easy to talk about. It's easy to sell. It's a job. It's very expensive to provide free programs to that many young people across the city.
What's your budget?
We're about $2.7 million. So it's a
doesn't seem like enough. Well, of course, it doesn't seem like enough to me. Yeah,
right. There's always can be more, but certainly the impact we're making on our programs, and that's the thing, was we don't just go in one lane. We're doing programs for many ages, many different ways that we're delivering.
What are the ages? Like, is it like 13 to maybe 24? You mentioned 24, 25 years old, or is it younger and older?
Sure, it depends on the program. So our touring and our residencies, our school-based programs, they can go anywhere from pre-K all the way up to 12th grade. Our street level program is mostly for older teens and the young adults. And then our teen arts pass is for 13 through 19 year olds.
That is what we're going to concentrate on, because I am incredibly taken with this teen arts pass, because I know a little girl who has availed herself of this, my little girl, who happens to be 14. And I think it's one of the best programs I've ever heard about. We got to take a little commercial break, then we'll come back and we'll spend the rest of this program telling you about teen Arts Pass. So get a pencil and paper, if you still use pencil and paper, and take down some information, because this is summer's here too, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're going to spend, first I'm going to tell you, I don't know if anybody can go to this. Can anybody go to this, Eric Delibo?
As long as you're 21 older, yeah.
Okay, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, on June 10th, which is a week from today, yes? June 10th. Yes. Yeah, it's a week from today. From 5:30 to 8:30 at Lagunitas Tap Room, where everything seems to happen, there's a fundraiser for the Urban Gateways Associate Board, and Lagunitas are putting this on. $15, and it goes to such a good cause. And it's a place, if you don't want to go to the urbangateways.org website, you can learn more about it from the people who run it. You'll be there, right?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, be on Monday.
To say, where's Eric? Where's Eric? Where's Eric? Is it a Monday?
It is a Monday.
Oh, it is a Monday. I'm sorry. I can't even add. Tomorrow is June 3rd. And it is on June 10th, so a week from Monday. Okay, the Teen Arts Pass started when? Whose idea was it? What genius came up with this?
it's been around for 1 year. This was a few years ago. We were doing a lot of field trips. We were moving kids back and forth across the city. One that you're familiar with Mona Golubek.
Oh my God, Children of Wollaston Lane.
Yeah, we did a few years ago. And which was wonderful. We had 6,000 kids go through the Harris Theater for that show.
Wow.
And we love doing those. But I was starting to think there's got to be a better way to connect kids to more theater. So they go see a wonderful show. How do we get more kids out there? I met someone from a wonderful organization in Seattle called Teen Ticks, who explained to me their model. And I sat there for about 10 seconds. I looked him in the eye and he said, I'm taking your I'm stealing your idea. I'm bringing it to Chicago. And not only that, we hired them as consultants to come and help adapt the model from Seattle to Chicago. So it launched a year ago. And it's incredibly simple.
Oh, it is so easy. Yeah. Go ahead, explain it.
Yeah, absolutely. Any teen ages 13 through 19 simply goes to teenartspass.org. They register for free. It takes about 2 minutes. Right away, we email you a card that gives you your registration card, and later we'll mail you a physical card. From there, you just start looking at the events page, and if there is a show on there, all you have to do is call the box office. Any day of show, if there is an unsold ticket at that venue, that teen can buy it for $5 cash. So all I have to do is call the box office. They say there's tickets available. They head to the box office with a $5 bill, and they're in the door. And every participating partner also offers at least once a week, if not more, a companion ticket, so that young person can also take mom or dad or older brother or a non-TAP member.
Parent.
Yeah, parent, anybody.
Yeah, I have found this to be an astonishing program, and I know a number of people who have used it to their benefit, to see shows at Looking Glass. I don't know if they've seen Hamilton, but I would imagine that even some kids have gotten in a teen pass on Hamilton.
We're not a Hamilton yet.
You aren't? That's ridiculous.
We're trying to get the for-profit theaters to pay attention, but we do have 26 amazing partners, and they were chosen for their geographic representation. We wanted venues all across the city, large, small, medium, music, dance, theater, so there was enough of a variety so young people can find what they're looking for. And maybe not have to go all about, but certainly West Side Story has been very popular. The Nutcracker is always
that's
very
a lyric.
Popular.
West Side Story, yeah, that's a lyric. Yeah. Kids have gone for $5 to see it with companion.
Yeah, so our 26 partners who span the city, again, are completely amazing, and they understand that benefit, right? They can either have an empty seat, or they can invite a teen in for $5.
Or they can nurture, there are a lot of kids. I remember I taught at Columbia College for one horrifying semester when I was teaching an arts and criticism class, and I sent, because I was involved in so many theaters, I said, you know what we'll do? I can't teach you to be a critic in 9 weeks, so go see a show, write a review, come back, we'll talk about it, then go see another show. And they went to Zanies, they went to the Goodman, and one kid, 18 years old, wrote a review, started out with a play, the play, whatever it was, at the Goodman, is very much like a television show, but the actors are real and they're in front of you. And I thought, I kept reading and I realized, oh my God, he's never seen a play before.
Yeah.
Which is really something. And I think theater for kids, especially in this movie video age, can be a life-altering experience.
Absolutely. Theater, and you know, what's so great is listening to the young people who go. The symphony is also incredibly popular. Now, some young people don't see classical music as something that they could ever be into.
Yeah.
But I keep hearing over and over again, once they sit down and they talk about the music just simply moving through them, they're going back.
See, but the other thing, it's the intimacy of the experience too, and the visual, visceral feel. You know, if you sat down and played a classical piece for a classroom.
Yeah.
I'll give you that there may be some people who go, this is boring, but if they are sitting there watching the dozens of instruments, it's a vastly different and, I think, more enriching experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, well, the two things that we were trying to tackle was, one was the cost of the show, and also sure. centralizing the information. So it's very hard for, you know, even adults, but teens, to figure out what is really available. And what they also know about the program is all the partners have undergone training to understand when a teen walks into your space that you have to go above and beyond to make sure that they feel as welcome as possible.
Not intimidated. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Some of these places can be kind of intimidating.
Well, the Lyric, walking in, no question.
Yeah. But the partners have been absolutely
What are some of your
excellent.
Other partners?
Let's see. We've got the Lyric and the Goodman and the Symphony Downtown. We've got
Looking
Black
Glass,
Ensemble
obviously.
Theater, Looking Glass.
What
Black
about
Ensemble
Court?
Court, yes.
In Hyde Park.
University of Chicago, Logan Center, ETA Arts. Yeah. So
now,
a lot
I am sure
of
when you went to these institutions and made your pitch, how did you make the pitch? What did you say to them? And who did you meet? You met, obviously maybe not Bob Fosse at the Goodman, but maybe Bob Fosse, who knows, or Brock Schulfer.
Yeah, it was either the executive directors, and certainly we reached out to the marketing folks. They're the ones charged with selling tickets.
Yeah, filling
so,
seats.
You know, we put it as a value proposition. You can leave it empty and have $0. You can get $5, but also have a future patron. I must say, some of these partners, though, have been doing a lot of work reaching out to young people
exactly.
and doing education programs.
Yeah.
So many were already bought in, and what they really liked about it was it made sense. Every experience is supposed to be the same for the teenagers. So there isn't different rules for different places. They know when they go from one venue to the other, it's the same process no matter what. And really buying into the notion that, again, young people have something to offer being in that space.
No question.
Yeah.
Well, it's your future audience. You don't have to do, it is audience development on its most frugal and inexpensive level. You are nurturing future theater goers.
Yeah.
What do you hear from kids? How many, do you have a number of how many kids there are availing themselves of TAP?
Yeah, just in 1 year, we've got over 6,000 young people that have signed up, and about 2,000 tickets have already been sold throughout
wow.
the city, and it's growing every day. So that's really exciting. We're again trying to find funding to continue pushing this, getting the word out. We've been investing in CTA ads, everything from sort of high-tech outreach to low-tech. So the low-tech is going to schools and physically signing up, having our council. We have a TAP Teen Council, a group of young people who we pay to actually give us advice on how to talk to teens.
Wow,
what
that
kind
must,
of words
those
do
must
we
be
use?
Interesting
oh,
conversations.
It's great. Yeah.
Holy God!
So they're really critical to this success of the program, to really make sure that young people know that it's by and for teens. That's what's really critical.
Do you expect this to pick up in the summer? Because I remember, there used to be summer jobs for teenagers, and I know there aren't anymore. And this is, and I know all kids don't want to be theater nerds, but a lot of them, it's a bold an interesting and new thing for kids to do.
Yeah, we're gonna see. This will really be, I think, our first test. The trouble is that many of the theaters are starting to wind down their season, so yeah. The calendar is a little thin. We do work with the city, though, with all the free events, and we make sure that the kids understand that there's a lot out there to see. But it's really about, again, agency and knowing that they can go out and try something. Who knows, they might be blown away, or they might not like it at all.
They're
out $5 in a couple hours of their time, but they probably got something out of it.
And they may have gone to a neighborhood they've never been in before. They may, if they go to Looking Glass, they see the water tower for the first time.
It really comes full circle to what Urban Gateways was founded on. And that's what's really great. Almost 60 years later, Urban Gateways is still focusing on making sure that young people know that the city is theirs. What we're just doing with this program is giving them the agency. It's, you know, we'll do a field trip and say, hey, kids, we're gonna put you on a bus, you're going to go see the ballet, and you're going to go back to your school, and you're going to love it, I promise. Now it's, you want to go see the ballet, go see the ballet. You want to go see jazz, go see jazz.
Well, it's also a way for them to learn self-sufficiency.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's a real confidence building thing in two little kids, everybody's a little kid to me, but two little kids, you know, one day going downtown to see a show, see a play. In the couple of minutes we have left, what's the biggest challenge facing you, Ari, Lily Bobby, and Urban Gateways?
Sure. I think what you said before, making sure that everybody understands what Urban Gateways does, that it really is a Chicago institution, that it really is essential to the fabric of our city, what we're doing, that we're trying to foster the next generation of artists, arts patrons, art appreciators. And even if they don't go in the arts, we know that these experiences set up young people for success later in life.
Yeah, there's no question.
Yeah. I mean, and just making sure that we can get this work done. Our partnerships have been amazing. We do get a lot of support, but more is needed. The need is there. Young people need these experiences, and we're ready to keep expanding.
I think the need is increasingly there. Yeah. I'm not calling it some crisis moment, but it's increasingly there. It is a pleasure to finally meet you face-to-face, and I could not admire what you do any more than I already do.
Oh,
but then I also write about it, and that's what I actually do for a living. Eric Delibovi, you can go to urbangateways.org. It's a wonderful website. You can hear about this party a week from Monday, but you can also hear about TAP. If you've got a teenager in your family, let's say you like to go to theater. Just, okay, your kid's 13. Make him become a TAP member and make him take you as his guest, his or her guest, every time. Thank you all for listening. Roel Coleman, thanks for this extraordinary producing job today, and you, Dan Long, for engineering brilliantly. Thanks to all of you guests. Carl Amari is coming up, and I will, God willing, see you next Sunday.